KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
On a sad and dramatic morning, this is live special coverage on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We have been following the news of a collision that took place last night in midair near Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. 64 passengers were on board Flight 5342 from Wichita, Kansas. It collided with a U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter that was carrying three people.
We have a lot of information, a lot of data points. We don't really have answers, and we're going to continue gathering information through this day and without doubt days to come. Any moment now, President Trump will speak from the White House briefing room. We'll hear any information that the president has. We will note, as we do in all breaking stories, that whatever you learn in the first day or so often proves to be untrue. Assertions, even by officials, often prove not to be true or not to be relevant, but we gather the information that we can. We try to put it together as responsibly as we can and go from there as we learn more over time. NPR national correspondent Joel Rose is with us this morning, one of our correspondents covering this story. And Joel, what are you learning so far about what happened in what order as we wait for the president?
Right. Well, as you said, the American Airlines Flight 5342 from Wichita, Kansas, was approaching Reagan National Airport in Virginia. Narrow body plane, CRJ-700 built by Bombardier, carrying 60 passengers, four crew members. It was lining up to land at the airport on what authorities have described as a perfectly normal approach when it collided at low altitude with a U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter with three soldiers on board. The eyewitnesses describe hearing a loud bang and seeing a bright explosion in the sky. There is webcam footage, in fact, of this online that you can see for yourself. The plane is coming in low over the river as planes landing at this airport often do every day, hundreds of times. And
Joel, I want to break. Yeah, and then you see the explosion. I want to break right in there as we await the president, Joel, because there's a couple of things we heard earlier this morning from Randy Babbitt. He's a former FAA administrator in charge of the people who guide the planes. He's also a former commercial airline pilot who said that he was based in Washington and has done this pattern hundreds, if not thousands, of times. And he said a couple of things that I want to follow up on. You said it was a normal approach. Mr. Babbitt was on of the understanding that the plane changed runways. What happened so far as we know?
Steve, I want to caveat this with, as you said, this is an evolving story, and I'm not sure we know exactly. But, it is the case, as far as I know, that the plane did adjust its approach to switch from one runway to an alternate runway that's sort of on a different angle. But I've also heard that this is not unusual at this airport, that planes sometimes request to change runways as they approach, and that in and of itself is not so out of the ordinary as to raise eyebrows.
Right. It's a thing that happens. There's a reason there are multiple runways there. The other thing that Randy Babbitt mentioned, and again, we are not knowing at this point what information is most relevant, is that the pilot of the helicopter, according to the air traffic control tapes that we've heard, was asked, "Do you see the plane?" And they said, "Yes, do you see the plane?" Babbitt raises the question, did they see the correct plane? Did they see the same plane that the air traffic controllers meant? Now, we don't know, and anyway, the answer to that question, but I was thinking about the video you just referenced. I've seen that video. There's more than one plane visible. This is a very crowded airspace, isn't it?
It is. It's one of the most congested airspaces in the country. Planes take off and land, about a minute apart throughout most parts of the day. And you're absolutely right about that video. You can see the plane that has just taken off. It's much larger. It's closer to the webcam, and you can see it taking off over the Potomac River. And this is a question that I have, and I'm sure many other people have as well. Did the helicopter see the correct plane?
Yeah.
And
Joel,
I don't know that we're going to have the answer to that today, but I think it's a question people are going to
ask. Joel, stay with us as we bring more voices into the conversation.
Joel, thanks for your reporting on this. We also are going to hear from NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith, and she is with us now from the briefing room. We are awaiting a statement or a press conference with President Trump, and as we wait for him, we want to hear from Tam. Tam, good morning.
Good morning.
Tam, the president has already said something about this on his social media site, Truth Social. What has he said about this so far?
Yeah, he put out a couple of messages on social media, including one saying that he's been fully briefed on the terrible accident which took place. He said, may God bless their souls. That was put out some time ago. He also wrote, what a terrible night this has been. God bless you all, exclamation point. And then there was another Truth Social post where he seemed to be sort of commenting on the events in sort of a detached way. He said that the airplane was on a perfect and routine line of approach to the airport. The helicopter was going straight at the airplane for an extended period of time. It is a clear night. Unclear exactly what that was based on, but what we do know is that the president is expected here for his first visit since being reelected, his first visit to the James Brady press briefing room, where he will brief the press and really the American people.
And I do want to point out that we can hear voices behind you. I want to point out you are in the briefing room at the moment. There are a number of journalists there who are also, like you, preparing, you know, the people listening for what they may be about to hear from the president. You know, presidents are looked to as consolers in times of national tragedy. This is something that I think his predecessor, Mr. Biden, took very seriously. What is Mr. Trump's record on that?
You know, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot today, because he's only been in office for a little bit more than a week, but last Friday he was in North Carolina and California, sites of two significant natural disasters. And he was really there as consoler-in-chief, talking to people who had lost their homes or had their homes damaged, saying that he was with the people of North Carolina and also the people of California. Now, once again, just, you know, a week and a half into his presidency, he's being called on again to be a consoler-in-chief after this air tragedy.
Well, he's not the only member of the administration. Well, clearly he's the head of the administration, but we've heard from Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy. He was out at the site of the National Airport. What has he said about this so far?
Right. Sean Duffy said that that they will be doing a full investigation, obviously. He also said that the aircraft were, in theory, in the right place, that they need to figure out what was happening and how it happened. Also, Pete Hegseth, the newly installed defense secretary, put out a video statement this morning. He talked about it as well, because there was this Army helicopter involved. He said that the crew was fairly experienced and that they were on a required annual night evaluation, and they did have night goggles. He said an investigation is being conducted to understand whether the aircraft was in the right quarter at the right altitude at the time of the incident.
And let's just listen to a little bit of Pete Hegseth, the newly confirmed Secretary of Defense, and a little bit of his video explanation from a statement that was put out a little bit earlier today. Let's listen.
The unit involved, the Army unit involved, was Bravo Company 12th Aviation Battalion at Fort Belvoir. It was an annual proficiency training flight. And when we look at the crew, and we're not all kin have been notified, so we're going to withhold ranks and names at this point.
So he says annual proficiency training flight. So they're getting their practice rounds in, Joel Rose. It doesn't sound like these were new pilots. In fact, I believe Hegseth described them as experienced pilots. It's at night that would affect their vision, but he also gave the detail that they had night vision goggles.
And that's one of those details that may turn out to be significant in the investigation and may not. And I think, you know, let's just keep that in mind as we evaluate this. But it's certainly a new detail from Pete Hegseth in the last
Joel,
hour or so.
Joel, talk a little bit about that D.C. airspace for people who have never been there. I mean, as you know, many people who have been there realize it's a beautiful approach, very picturesque. If you're sitting at the window, you can see the monuments, you fly over. But it has some very specific requirements because it's a small airport, because it's in a congested space, and because it's so busy. Can you talk a little bit about what's perhaps, you know, unique about that D.C. airspace?
Yeah, it is highly congested. There's no doubt about that. There's a lot of restrictions on the airspace because of the seat of government is here, you know, the White House, the Pentagon, you know, so there's a lot of restrictions. And that makes for a difficult approach for pilots who have to take a fairly narrow corridor of approach to the runway, whether they're coming from the north or, as this plane was doing, coming up from the south. And it is kind of a spectacular landing. You know, it's one of those old airports that's right on the water, and you don't notice the runway coming up below you until you're already on top of it.
Boom, yeah.
And boom, and then you're on the ground.
And
you do get a pretty amazing view
yeah.
of the Mall, of the Washington Monument, of the Capitol Building, of the nation's capital.
People on that plane, it's awful to think about, 1 second before the collision would have been passing Alexandria, Virginia, would have been looking out at what's called the Washington Monument, or on the other side of the plane, the more famous Washington Monument in the distance in D.C., 1 second before that. But it is a very difficult, complicated process to keep everything in order. And we heard earlier today from Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, who's been involved in debates about congestion at that airport. Let's listen to some of that.
And those of us who live here, we know how complicated and congested an airspace this is. You have commercial flights, you have military flights, you have, you know, the president being flown on Marine One from Andrews into the White House often. So it's a congested airspace with some special rules. But a number of us have been sounding the alarm about congestion for some time.
Joel Rose, let's talk about super basics here. Who's in charge of managing that congestion?
The Federal Aviation Administration is in charge of the U.S. airspace. Senator Kaine was involved in what became a fairly politicized fight over this particular airspace around Reagan National Airport in recent years. Some airlines had been pushing to add more flights in and out of the airport, while other airlines were pushing to keep things as they are. And they both groups really enlisted members of Congress to sort of in a proxy fight, on both sides of this issue. And with Senator Kaine and other lawmakers from Maryland and Virginia, strongly opposed to adding more flights at DCA. And they pointed to congestion as a concern. I will say, though, this was all studied extensively. And in the end, there was a decision to grant a few more flight slots, though not as many as the airlines had perhaps hoped. But it was a high-profile battle. I mean, this is sort of Congress's airport. That's its reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Members who want to catch a quick weekend flight home, like everyone else who lives in Washington, D.C., would prefer to take it out of Reagan National than to go to one of the further out airports. So it's a contested resource for sure.
If you're just joining us, I'd like to remind you that we are awaiting a commentary from President Trump after this deadly mid-air collision last night out just outside of Washington Reagan National Airport, as a helicopter and a passenger plane were both approaching the airport, a passenger jet coming from Wichita, Kansas. Joel, I wanted to just go back to the statement that President Trump made last night on his social media platform, Truth Social. Tam discussed the first part of it, where he talked about that this is a perfect and routine line of approach. But he goes on to say that it was a clear night in all caps. The lights on the plane were blazing. Why didn't the helicopter go up or down or turn? Asked why didn't the control tower, tell them what to do instead of asking them. I'm just sort of wondering, are those questions that investigators would actually be asking at this point? I don't know how the president knows those things, or perhaps he was briefed before he made these comments. But are those questions that investigators are in fact asking?
Some of them, for sure. I mean, my understanding is that there was communication between the control tower and the helicopter. I mean, there is audio of those communications that's circulating. And there is the air traffic controllers can be heard to be asking the helicopter pilot, can you see the plane? And I think, Steve mentioned this a little bit earlier. Can you see the plane? And the helicopter pilot responds affirmatively. So there was communication, and the air traffic controller instructed the helicopter pilot to go behind the plane. Clearly that, is not what happened, tragically. And so we are left with a lot of questions about why.
Yeah,
it didn't happen, I don't think we, waiting for answers.
We have to be real about the questions that we raise, the questions that the president asks, the facts that we're putting on the table. We don't know what's most relevant here. We just talked about congestion, which is real in that area and something that I want to hear from the transportation secretary about in just a moment. And yet at the same time, Joel, we're talking about just one aircraft colliding with just one other aircraft. There's a scenario where that could have happened with no other airplane in the sky. We do not know for sure that congestion played any role. We do not know whether we should be pointing the finger particularly at the helicopter. We do not know. We know the facts that we have. We don't know how it all fits together. Let's hear a little bit of Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, who talks about what was normal in this incident up until the second of collision.
The helicopter was in a standard pattern. If you live in the D.C. area, you'll see helicopters up and down the river. This flight pattern is seen oftentimes when you live in D.C. This was a standard flight pattern last night as well. The American Airlines flight coming into land was in a standard flight pattern as it was coming into DCA. So the
way that the sentence ends in the middle is almost appropriate. We don't know entirely what this means. So, Joel, let's talk a little bit about the process. Who investigates an air disaster, and whatever assumptions or questions or facts that turn out to be relevant or not we talk about now, who is it that tries to figure out on a more scientific basis what most likely happened?
The leading agency is the National Transportation Safety Board. They are already on site and preparing for their first briefing, which we expect sometime later today. They take the lead. They're an independent agency. They're outside of the chain of command of the Transportation Department, and deliberately so. They are independent because they're supposed to follow the facts to figure out exactly what happened. They do not work quickly, but they work rigorously, and they will spend a long time getting to the bottom of this.
I covered plane crashes many years ago in the 1990s when they were far more frequent, I suppose we should mention. There were
that
multiple
is correct. Absolutely.
Air disasters, and there would be, I can remember a particular plane crash where there was a press conference and also briefings privately with NTSB people, and they would unveil, it seemed, a new fact every day that completely changed your understanding of what on earth happened, and then the same thing would happen again 24 hours later. And it might have been years before they reached a final conclusion about some of these disasters. But with that noted, I want to mention also, Joel Rose, if we look back the last few years, there have not been a bunch of air disasters in the United States.
No, this has been sort of an unprecedented period of safety in U.S. aviation that has now come tragically to a close with this incident. But, I mean, it has been more than two decades since we have seen a disaster of this magnitude in the U.S. airspace. I mean, you have to go all the way back to November of 2001 when an American Airlines jet crashed in Queens to find an incident like this.
Last year, there was enormous attention about a panel coming out in an airplane, and it was an accident in which no one died, which has been...
Yeah, the plane landed safely. That's exactly right. I mean, we have... Secretary Sean Duffy said today that the U.S. airspace is the safest in the world, and that is true. I mean, the data backs that up. We have, and it's because of, systems like the NTSB, the investigators who figure out what went wrong in incidents like this, who produce a rigorous report, and so everyone knows how to avoid this particular mistake in the future. And we have years and years and years of experience and accumulated wisdom about how to be safer in the skies. And it has worked. The system has worked incredibly well. Unfortunately, it did not work last night.
Let's go back to our senior White House correspondent, Tamara Keith, at the White House. And as I mentioned, we are awaiting remarks by President Trump at the White House about this tragedy. Tam, one of the things that was noteworthy about Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, who, as all these cabinet secretaries, are very new in the job, appearing with officials from Virginia at National Airport, along with the mayor of Washington, D.C., and local officials and others who are responding to this event. You know, that this president has taken, and, other members of the cabinet, those who've been confirmed so far, and his nominees have taken a very sort of aggressive and pugnacious attitude toward other sectors of the government. That was noticeably different at that press conference at Washington National. In fact, the Transportation Secretary took pains to praise the kind of bipartisan and the coordinated response from all the agencies, including the mayor of Washington. And I just wondered if you noted that as well and what you make of it.
Yeah, and Michelle, I'll just note that about 90 seconds ago, we got a two-minute warning. Okay. So we are expecting to see the president here in the James Brady press briefing room pretty soon.
Well, why don't you take us up to when the president comes in, and you'll let us know when he comes in. So
tell me. I will. Yeah. So I will say that, you know, in a disaster, in a tragedy, leaders rise above whatever else they might be arguing about or disagreeing over. You saw this out in California with the wildfires, even though there were dramatic disagreements about even the facts of why water was unavailable. You still saw the president and members of Congress from opposing parties agreeing that they wanted to work together and do everything they could to help the people who had been affected by those fires. And you have the same thing here, where there are multiple jurisdictions in what we call the DMV, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, federal government, the D.C. government, Virginia, Maryland. They were all involved in search and rescue efforts and ultimately now recovery efforts. And working together, you had senators from, Republican senators from Kansas at the same press conference as Democratic senators from Virginia. And so coming together around this. And we're expecting President Trump to come into this room and deliver a message to the American people as the president of the United States, the president for all Americans and Americans who are dealing with what is a traumatic event. As you had said, there has not been an air tragedy like this in the United States in a long time, and it is jarring for people.
Can I ask you again, and you'll let us know when the president arrives and begins his comments, Tam. So you've covered this president for a long time. We know that President Biden really embraced this notion.
And the door is open.
And the door is open, and here's President Trump.
Thank you. I'd like to request a moment of silence for the victims and their families, please.
And we'll note live special coverage from NPR News.
Thank you very much. I speak to you this morning in an hour of anguish for our nation. Just before 9 p.m. last night, an American Airlines regional jet carrying 60 passengers and four crew collided with an Army Black Hawk helicopter carrying three military service members over the Potomac River in Washington, D.C., while on final approach to Reagan National Airport. Both aircraft crashed instantly and were immediately submerged into the icy waters of the Potomac. Real tragedy. The massive search and rescue mission was underway throughout the night, leveraging every asset at our disposal. And I have to say, the local, state, federal, military, including the United States Coast Guard in particular, they've done a phenomenal job. So quick, so fast, it was mobilized immediately. The work has now shifted to a recovery mission. Sadly, there are no survivors. This was a dark and excruciating night in our nation's capital and in our nation's history, and a tragedy of terrible proportions. As one nation, we grieve for every precious soul that has been taken from us so suddenly. And we are a country of really, we are in mourning. This is really shaking a lot of people, including people, very sadly, from other nations who were on the flight. For the family members back in Wichita, Kansas, here in Washington, D.C., and throughout the United States and in Russia, we have a Russia contingent, some very talented people. Unfortunately, we're on that plane. Very, very, very sorry about that. Whose loved ones were aboard the passenger jet. We can only begin to imagine the agony that you're all feeling, nothing worse. On behalf of the First Lady, myself, and 340 million Americans, our hearts are shattered alongside yours, and our prayers are with you now. And in the days to come, we'll be working very, very diligently in the days to come. We're here for you to wipe away the tears and to offer you our devotion, our love, and our support. There's great support. In moments like this, the differences between Americans fade to nothing compared to the bonds of affection and loyalty that unite us all, both as Americans and even as nations. We are one family, and today we are all heartbroken. We're all searching for answers. That icy, icy Potomac was a cold, cold night, cold water. We're all overcome with the grief for many who have so tragically perished, will no longer be with us. Together we take solace in the knowledge that their journey ended not in the cold waters of the Potomac, but in the warm embrace of a loving God. We do not know what led to this crash, but we have some very strong opinions and ideas, and I think we'll probably state those opinions now. Because over the years, I've watched as things like this happen, and they say, well, we're always investigating, and then the investigation, 3 years later, they announce it. We think we have some pretty good ideas, but we'll find out how this disaster occurred, and we'll ensure that nothing like this ever happens again. The FAA and the NTSB and the U.S. military will be carrying out a systematic and comprehensive investigation. Our new Secretary of Transportation, Sean Duffy, his second day on the job when that happened. It's a rough one. We'll be working tirelessly. He's a great gentleman. The whole group these are great people. And they are working tirelessly to figure out exactly what happened. We will state certain opinions, however. I'm also immediately appointing an acting commissioner to the FAA, Christopher Rocheleau, a 22-year veteran of the agency, highly respected. Christopher, thank you very much. Appreciate it. We must have only the highest standards for those who work in our aviation system. I changed the Obama standards from very mediocre at best to extraordinary. You remember that. Only the highest aptitude, they have to be the highest intellect and psychologically superior people, were allowed to qualify for air traffic controllers. That was not so prior to getting there. When I arrived in 2016, I made that change very early on because I always felt this was a job that, and other jobs too, but this was a job that had to be superior intelligence. And we didn't really have that, and we had it. And then when I left office and Biden took over, he changed them back to lower than ever before. I put safety first. Obama, Biden, and the Democrats put policy first. And they put politics at a level that nobody's ever seen, because this was the lowest level. Their policy was horrible, and their politics was even worse. So as you know, last week, long before the crash, I signed an executive order restoring our highest standards for air traffic controllers and other important jobs throughout the country. So it was very interesting. About a week ago, almost upon entering office, I signed something last week that was an executive order, very powerful one, restoring the highest standards of air traffic controllers and others, by the way. Then my administration will set the highest possible bar for aviation safety. We have to have our smartest people. It doesn't matter what they look like, how they speak, who they are. It matters intellect, talent, the word talent. They have to be talented, naturally talented geniuses. You can't have regular people doing that job. They won't be able to do it. But we'll restore faith in American air travel. I'll have more to say about that. I do want to point out that various articles that appeared prior to my entering office. And here's one. The FAA's diversity push includes focus on hiring people with severe intellectual and psychiatric disabilities. That is amazing. And then it says FAA says people with severe disabilities are most underrepresented segment of the workforce, and they want them in, and they want them. They can be air traffic controllers. I don't think so. This was in January 14th, so that was a week before I entered office. They put a big push to put diversity into the FAA's program. Then another article, the Federal Aviation Administration, this was before I got to office recently, second term. The FAA is actively recruiting workers who suffer severe intellectual disabilities, psychiatric problems, and other mental and physical conditions under a diversity and inclusion hiring initiative spelled out on the agency's website. Can you imagine? These are people that are, I mean, actually, their lives are shortened because of the stress that they have. Brilliant people have to be in those positions. And their lives are actually shortened, very substantially shortened because of the stress, where you have many, many planes coming into one target. And you need a very special talent and a very special genius to be able to do it. Targeted disabilities are those disabilities that the federal government, as a matter of policy, has identified for special emphasis in recruitment and hiring. The FAA's website states they include hearing, vision, missing extremities, partial paralysis, complete paralysis, epilepsy, severe intellectual disability, psychiatric disability, and dwarfism all qualify for the position of a controller of airplanes pouring into our country, pouring into a little spot, a little dot on the map, a little runway. The initiative is part of the FAA's diversity and inclusion hiring plan. Think of that. The initiative is part of...
President Trump, talking at the White House today, his first appearance in the White House briefing room during his second term as president, discussing the crash of American Eagle Flight 5342, a plane out of Wichita, Kansas, that crashed over the Potomac when striking a U.S. Army helicopter. The president saying in his remarks, quote, "We are one family," but then going on to say that he had strong opinions about what had happened, and we will, quote, state those opinions now. You just heard the president referring to news articles about a diversity push at the Federal Aviation Administration, a story that the FAA had been encouraging people with intellectual disabilities to apply for jobs at the FAA. I've since looked up the story. It appears that that had been the policy for a good number of years, although it was discussed on the internet by Elon Musk, the president's close advisor, in more recent times. It's not clear at all, of course, that people with intellectual disabilities were asked to be air traffic controllers, one of the kinds of employees at this giant agency, the Federal Aviation Administration, nor is it clear that air traffic controllers played any particular role in the crash that we are discussing today. NPR's Joel Rose covers aviation and has been listening into this, and so we're going to bring Joel Rose in a moment to talk a little bit about the president's remarks. Joel, do you feel you're learning anything here?
Well, I think the news for me was that the there is now an acting FAA administrator, Christopher Rochelot, and I have to admit that I don't have a lot of information about him to share, but I can tell you why the chair is empty. FAA Administrator Michael Whitaker served just over a year during the Biden administration and departed at the end of the Biden administration. There have been times when the FAA administrator has stayed on across administrations. That did not happen in this case, so the post has been vacant for at least weeks, less than a month. But the post was vacant, and now the president has filled it with an acting administrator. So that was new here. And, you know, we could talk more about the some of the other things the president said.
Well, I'll just note the FAA made a statement when this made the rounds on social media, and you're listening to, we'll continue this coverage. You're listening to NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We have our national correspondent, Frank Langfitt, with us now to talk more about this breaking story that we've been covering all morning and actually since last night, where a passenger jet, an American Airlines passenger jet, collided with a Black Hawk helicopter right near Washington National Airport. We've been listening to President Trump give his take on these tragic events. He offered his condolences to the nation, but very quickly pivoted to blaming a prior administration, what he called lowering the standards for people in these positions. We don't know that. We will obviously be pursuing the facts of this story as it unfolds. And our national correspondent, Frank Langfitt, is with us now to talk more about this. Good morning, Frank.
Hey, good morning, Michelle.
So we've learned a couple of things since these events of last night. We learned that there were a number of Russian nationals on the flight. They were participating in a sort of a figure skating, I don't know if a competition or a training experience in Wichita, Kansas. And we are learning that, and interestingly, President Trump offered his condolences to the Russian nation as well as to the United States, American citizens, in the wake of this crash. But then he quickly pivoted, as we said, to complaints about what he called the lowering of standards for these positions. We don't know that to be true. We do know that there was a push to recruit people with different attributes for various roles within the FAA. Frank, what more can you tell us?
Well, none of this has come up this morning here. We had a briefing early in the morning, and we're expecting another one from the National Transportation Safety Board later. They take over these investigations, as you know. One of the things that's what I found kind of earlier, looking at Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, suggesting that they might have President Trump suggesting they might have an idea about what happened here. And one thing that Secretary Hegseth said this morning, I think was very interesting, he said, we anticipate the investigation will quickly be able to determine whether the aircraft was in the corridor and at the right altitude at the time of the incident. So already focusing in on exactly, whether both aircraft were on the right flight path. But, as we've talked about, these take a long, long time. They're very often very complex investigations. So too early to say what might have happened. And certainly here at Reagan National, no talk about diversity, no talk about those sorts of things here on the ground as investigators are getting going.
I understand that the National Airport, we learned this morning that National Airport would open to flights as of 11 o'clock today. The CEO of Reagan National said that. Is that true? Are flights starting to take off?
Well, I can't quite see the runway from where I'm actually sitting on one of those baggage carousels. It's not running at the moment, but there are people who are coming in. We were talking earlier with a woman who came in who was concerned about what had happened, wasn't sure, but she needed to get to Dallas, and so she's definitely flying today. I am seeing families coming in now. I am seeing people with lots of luggage resuming their plans for travel.
Okay, Frank. I just want to note another thing here. When we talk about how to put these investigations together, and this is intriguing to say the least, there are questions here. The president has raised questions about what the air traffic controllers did. His allegation from a news article that appeared last year. We have no idea if this has anything to do with anything, but one of the questions that will be legitimately asked in the investigation is, what did the air traffic controllers do? Who were the air traffic controllers involved? What did they say on the recording, which is something that we've heard? There was a conversation going back and forth between the tower and the U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter, but that's just one layer of this, and I'm reminded, as you talk about what the authorities have said at news conferences, of how complicated the air system is, and also how many layers upon layers upon layers of safety that there are. It doesn't normally take just one thing to go wrong to cause an aviation disaster. There has to be multiple things that go wrong all at the same time, sometimes only in a specific order. And if that doesn't happen, that helicopter misses that airplane, which is the normal thing that is supposed to happen.
Exactly. It's a very complex system, and unraveling exactly what happened, in the dark, a little before 9 p.m. last night over the Potomac River, is going to take a lot of time. I mean, obviously, the investigators will be focusing on air traffic control, but they'll also be focusing on the pilots of both planes. So again, it takes a lot of time. These can be very complicated. It's usually are often very complicated investigations. And so far, as I said, just here on the ground, the sort of things we've heard from President Trump this morning is not something we're hearing here yet, and we'll be looking forward to hearing from the National Transportation Safety Board, hopefully soon,
As a matter of fact, I believe Secretary Duffy has gone to the podium, and I wonder if we can return to the White House now and hear some of the remarks of Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy.
Commit to them that we are going to get to the bottom of this investigation, not in 3 years, not in 4 years, but as quickly as possible with the NTSB, who is here today, as well as the FAA. What happened yesterday shouldn't have happened. It should not have happened. And when Americans take off in airplanes, they should expect to land at their destination. That didn't happen yesterday. That's not acceptable. And so we will not accept excuses. We will not accept passing the buck. We are going to take responsibility at the Department of Transportation and the FAA to make sure we have the reforms that have been dictated by President Trump in place to make sure that these mistakes do not happen again. And again, I want to thank you for your leadership, Mr. President, I appreciate the confidence you placed in me.
Thank you very much.
Pete, would you like to say something?
We just heard from Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy.
President.
As the President said, he's only been on the job for 2 days. Now we're hearing from the newly installed Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth.
The moment we found out about this, we were in contact with the White House trying to determine exactly what happened. I would echo it as well. No excuses. We're going to get to the bottom of this. We first and foremost from the Defense Department want to pass our condolences to the 64 souls and their families that were affected by this. Never should happen. And certainly the three service members, the three soldiers, a young captain, staff sergeant, and a CW2, Chief Warrant Officer. On a routine annual retraining of night flights on a standard corridor for a continuity of government mission. The military does dangerous things. It does routine things on the regular basis. Tragically, last night, a mistake was made. And I think the president is right. There was some sort of an elevation issue that we have immediately begun investigating at the DOD and Army level. Army CID is on the ground investigating. Top-tier aviation assets inside the DOD are investigating, sir, to get to the bottom of it so that it does not happen again, because it's absolutely unacceptable. But I want to echo
Pete Hegseth. We're seeing him at the White House podium for the first time since his confirmation as Secretary of Defense, and he gives a useful statement there at the end saying there was some sort of an elevation issue. If the two aircraft are at a different altitude, even a slightly different altitude, they're not going to strike each other. Apparently they were at the same altitude, and that was part of this. We also heard from Sean Duffy, the Transportation Secretary, saying we will not accept passing the buck. We also heard the President of the United States, who did pass blame to the prior administration, making allegations based on a Fox News story from some time prior to the crash. We'll continue to bring you more information as we learn it right here on NPR News.
We've been bringing you stories about trash and climate change. Well, get ready to meet a couple who turned a passion for dumpster diving into a thriving business. Next time on Here and Now.
You wait for the bus, you wait for the weekend, your morning coffee to finish brewing. Well, you don't have to wait to get live news from NPR. Go to this station's website or npr.org on your phone.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. An antiques collector in Minnesota was looking at a garage sale and saw a painting of a fisherman with a pipe in his mouth. The collector bought the painting for $50, which apparently was a bargain. An art research firm believes it's a long-lost work of Vincent van Gogh. In Minnesota, researchers spent years and $30,000 authenticating this, and if they're correct, it could be worth $15 million. This morning edition. Crazy.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Fluoride has been used for decades in drinking water in many places to help prevent cavities, but now some are questioning that, and Florida has become ground zero for that debate. Molly Durig with Central Florida Public Media has this report.
Community water fluoridation has always had its critics, but generally those critics were mostly on the fringe, outliers. Things are different now.
We're just seeing more momentum, I think, than ever.
That's Justin Harvey, who lives right outside Orlando. Harvey says he's been trying to get local community leaders to take fluoride concerns seriously for the last 7 or 8 years, when he started hearing about concerns with the chemical on YouTube.
Before, it was no support. And these days, it's a little more opened up. I think the post-COVID world has changed that.
Harvey says now he senses a lot less trust in public health agencies, the government. That distrust was in the room at a recent city council meeting in Melbourne, one of the latest cities in Central Florida to reconsider fluoridating water, after hearing from fluoride critics like Warren Chris Edwards.
I am a practicing dentist of 47 years. The first half of my career, I supported fluoridation. That's what I was trained with in dental school. And that's what basically the government told us. The CDC and stuff, it was a scam. It was a marketing scam.
A harsh critique, inconsistent with research showing water fluoridation reduces the risk of tooth decay. But Edwards and other fluoride critics say a report from the National Institutes of Health validates their concerns. The report analyzed 74 studies, all done outside the United States. Only 22 of the studies were considered high quality. Of those, most found cognitive impacts or reduced IQ in children were associated with fluoride exposure, but only at a level twice as high as what's currently recommended for drinking water here.
So you're comparing apples to oranges.
That's Yoshida Patel Hosking, immediate past president of the Florida Academy for Pediatric Dentistry, also a local dentist who spoke at the meeting in support of fluoridation to prevent cavities.
You're comparing something at a much higher dosage in its margin of safety that is not safe to something that is very, very safe.
And the fact fluoride exposures were associated with those cognitive outcomes does not mean the fluoride caused them. The review itself states more studies are needed. Still, the review was enough to convince a federal judge to rule in September that, quote, fluoridation of water at 0.7 milligrams per liter, the level presently considered optimal in the United States, poses an unreasonable risk of reduced IQ in children. But the judge also said he can't say for sure that fluoridated water is harmful to public health. He directed the Environmental Protection Agency to look further into the possibility.
I think fluoride is on the way out because of that court decision.
That's President Donald Trump's pick for Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., speaking with NBC News in November.
I think the faster that it goes out, the better.
A couple weeks later, Florida Surgeon General Joseph Latipo issued new state guidance on fluoride. Here he is speaking to news reporters.
It is public health malpractice with the information that we have now to continue adding fluoride to water systems in Florida.
Justin Harvey says Latipo's new guidance is fueling the movement he's been a part of for years to defluoridate Florida water.
That has just caused a ripple effect. We've had commissioners say, if the state is telling me this is public health malpractice, we should at least just pause, halt.
And that's what's been happening all over the Sunshine State, in places like Melbourne, where the city council voted 6-1 to stop fluoridating water. For NPR News, I'm Molly Durig.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. We have many news stories that are taking place this morning all at once. We are reporting on the mid-air collision last night over the Potomac River. Authorities now say there were no survivors in the crash of two aircraft. Kash Patel faces questions before a Senate committee on his nomination to lead the FBI. Amid all these developments, we keep following up on big news from earlier in the week. This is important. We got to keep going back and going back. President Trump's administration says it withdrew a memo that was telling federal agencies to stop trillions of dollars in spending mandated by Congress. The administration faced a lawsuit for seizing power that belonged to Congress, but the administration then made contradictory-seeming statements about whether they were rescinding the memo or going ahead with the president's priorities. So we called Patty Murray, Senator Democratic from Washington State, to ask if she believes the government is making payments as usual.
Well, that is the question on everyone's mind. I mean, the memo that came out on Monday night, late Monday night, across the board, across the country, to agencies everywhere, from community health centers to Head Start programs to domestic violence shelters. It was incredible, just saying we are freezing your funding. That can you imagine if you are a Head Start program and you're, do we open our doors this morning? Can I pay my staff? I mean, multiply that times hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. It was a huge violation of trust, but it was also a violation of law. The president doesn't have the authority to freeze spending like that. So this actually put everybody in chaos, and then we immediately, the public outpouring made a difference, and the president could, or his staff, put out another memo rescinding it, and then his White House staff, press secretary, said the exact opposite moments later. So I would say today, everyone is still confused. It is still chaotic.
Well, it occurs to me that by backing off the memo, the administration may avoid a court ruling against them and then preserve some ambiguity about what they can or can't do. And maybe they can go in and be more specific or more targeted in what spending they hold back. Would you concede the president may have some authority to hold back some money sometimes?
Look, it is very clear to me from day one that this administration is pushing what they call their ability to freeze federal funding, or the actual legal word is impound federal funding. That is in violation of our Constitution. It is in violation of our laws. The way this works, and it has been tried in courts many times, is that Congress has, quote, the power of the purse, meaning we come, we represent our districts, our states, we hammer out a budget and what our priorities are and our spending plans. We pass it with Democrats and Republicans in the House and Senate. The president signs it into law. He cannot then break that law and say, well, I like this part, but not this part. That's called impoundment, and it is illegal. But his administration has made it clear that they don't think the law should be there. So instead of fighting it in court, what they are doing is saying, we don't believe it's a good law, so we're just not going to do it. Their budget director, who's actually coming up to a vote in my committee today, said to me personally, to other members, and in his hearings, that he believes that that impoundment is not a fair law, and he is going to violate it.
Well, let's talk about that. Russ Vogt is the person you're talking about. He's been on NPR before. He has an expansive view of presidential authority that appears to match that of the president he proposes to serve. And you understand him to want a constitutional test here? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, what he's doing is obviously trying to get a constitutional test. But the fact is that this is law. They cannot ultimately say, well, we don't like this law, we don't like that law, so we're not going to follow it. We are a nation of laws. And this administration, the Trump administration, and the Republicans have made it clear that they just are going to violate every law and take it to court. We shouldn't run that way, because why? The exact chaos that has happened over the last several days.
Can I just mention, I mean, you're serving in the Senate with Republicans. Some of them, I'm sure you disagree with them about everything, but they're Republicans who might have your view of the institution. They disagree with you on policies, but Mitch McConnell comes to mind, somebody who sticks up for his institution, even if you disagree with everything he ever does. On this issue of the president trying to impound money, are you finding any Republicans who agree with your view and are willing to stick up for the institution as you see it?
Absolutely, and I'll tell you why. Because what goes around comes around. And if they violate this law and take it to the courts and try and undo it, or do undo it, it doesn't just apply to this administration. It applies to every administration in the future. So at a point when we have a Democratic president, it leaves Republicans saying, well, why should I agree on this bill and vote for it if the president can then just say, well, I'm going to support the Democrats side, but not what the Republicans asked for. An agreement is an agreement. You know, the bills that we pass that appropriate money across the board are done in a bipartisan vote. I don't have any memory in my mind in the number of years I've been here where appropriation bill passed only on Democratic votes or only on Republican votes and got signed into law. It takes both parties. It takes compromise. It takes agreement. If you go to the table and think, well, I'm compromising with you and passing this, but it doesn't really mean anything because the president's going to change it, where's the trust? You can't vote for that, Republicans or Democrats.
Let me ask another question about compromise. I read sometimes this Substack by Dan Pfeiffer, who's a former aide to President Obama, very interesting about politics, and he is arguing for Democrats to speak up more forcefully against this president and essentially to oppose everything that he does. Why give him any wins? Why say that I will vote for some of his cabinet nominees? Why give him any compromises, any victories? Do you feel you understand, in about 20 seconds, the approach that Democrats should take to President Trump over the next few months?
I think what we do is point out clearly and loudly, just like we did with this memo that came out Monday night, what is happening to real American families that are losing out by the actions this president has taken, and we have to vote accordingly.
Democratic Senator Patty Murray of Washington State, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Senator Murray talking with us on a very busy, busy, and in many ways tragic news day. Of course, another story that we're following today is the mid-air collision of an American Eagle flight, Flight 5342 out of Wichita, with a U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter. It happened over the Potomac River near Washington, D.C., and we're told there are no survivors. We'll continue to bring you more reliable information as we have it. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Thank you.